welcome to you all, obviously, and to Danny Dorling, who last time he came to speak here was Professor of Geography at Sheffield University, but now he's the Halford Mackinder Professor of Geography at the University of Oxford. I recently viewed online his inaugural lecture, and fascinating it was too. He was dressed up like a penguin in what they call sub-fuss, and at the beginning of the lecture he had to make several appropriate nods to various officials and so on. All the kind of things he loves to do, you know. But the thing that impressed me was that as he came into the hall to give his inaugural lecture, everybody had to stand up. Now, you're not going to get that tonight, I fear. But you have got a good audience. We can't find quite as many people as at Oxford, but they're an audience who come from real life, and they're a highly intelligent audience, I can assure you of that. And we've got in the audience, we've got senior planners, chairman of the Civic Society. I'm sure you get lots of interesting questions at the end there. Danny's academic career has included posts at Newcastle, the universities of Bristol, Leeds and Sheffield, the University of Canterbury in New Zealand, and a visiting professorship at Goldsmiths at the University of London. He took up his chair at Oxford in September last year. In the Times Higher Education paper, another distinguished geographer said of him, "Dorling is one of the very few geographers actively shaping public discourse in the UK. He's previously made high-profile interventions on issues including global and national population change, health, inequality, poverty and politics, and the relationships between them. His analysis and presentation have long been characterised by a clarity that is all too often absent from academic or academically informed writing." And that's what struck me more than anything when I was reading this book, is that it's written from the heart, and Danny is quite as happy, well, I have to use that word advisedly, he may not be as happy, he's quite as happy quoting from the Daily Mail and the Daily Telegraph and the mouths of estate agents as he is from abstruse academic papers. And I was frankly quite amazed when I was reading this book, because it seemed as though, I agree with all the underlying arguments, but the sheer depth of feeling that pours out from this book all the way through, it's as if a whole lifetime of frustration at politicians and all the policies of the policymakers was dragged out of the bag and shown for what it is truly worth. Now, I understand, I don't know where I got this from, but one of Danny's hobbies, or major pleasures actually, is building sandcastles. Is that true, is it? Yeah, good. And no doubt that stands him in good stead in dealing with politicians and policymakers. But if you think this is one of the more difficult aspects of his job, it apparently isn't. No, he says, "Dealing with particularly cynical or supercilious academics can be much harder than working with the most hard-nosed of policymakers." Well, discovering that he's mad on building sandcastles gave me an ideal introduction for his talk tonight. He may not have realised it, but his talk is going to be about the relationship between building sandcastles and bricks. So, without any more ado, over to Danny. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you so much for that introduction. I was very lucky to have a father whose hobby was building sandcastles. And as a child, there's nothing better than to go on holiday and your dad actually wants to build them more than you do. Because what you discover is that if your dad is building sandcastles, more and more children from the beach will gather around and will help to build it. And parents nowadays are not so good at this. So we've discovered that we can get up to 40 to 50 children joining in on the beach and doing this kind of thing. So that's part of insight into the kind of thing that interests me and how weird I am. But the book is a little bit about me, it has to be said. This wasn't the plan. I was asked probably 2.5 years ago if I'd write a book about housing by Penguin. And I said I would, because the first research I had done in the late 1980s, early 1990s, was about housing. That was my first research job, paid for by the Rowntree Foundation. and it was about homelessness and negative equity. So I thought, well, I knew a thing from then. I'd have a go doing it now. I'll write a book. It won't be that hard. It won't be that interesting, but I will do it. And you don't get asked that often from Penguin or from Allen Lane to write a book about housing. The reason it became more interesting and harder and more painful is that after having said I'd write the book and having begun to write the book, I decide and my family decides to move town. So we have to sell a house, we have to rent, we have to try and buy a house. And this is selling a house in Sheffield, which is a lovely place but is at the bottom end of the English housing market. Buying a house in Oxford, which is a lovely place but at the top end of the housing market, during a runaway boom, at a time when the Chancellor decides that he's going to go all out to do whatever he can to elevate house prices, as you personally are trying to buy a house in the city just so that your kids can go to school there and you can actually do your job. So I'm afraid that has altered what's in the book, if you're interested in the book. And I think it's made it more interesting, but it clearly has a bias sort of effect, particularly on estate agents. Now, there's probably been an estate agent here, and I've got a sympathy for estate agents, but I have met 60 estate agents in the last 2 years in the process of trying to buy houses. And estate agency is one of the few jobs that's actually expanding in Britain. So 2 years ago, one in four of all new jobs in England and Wales, at least, were estate agents. Last year, one in three of all new jobs were estate agents. And you've got this kind of runaway, heated, overexcited housing market in the south of England. And then in the north of England, you've got kind of problem selling houses. It's gone down. And if you move across this border, and I'd like you to tell me exactly where we are on that border here, and what's happening, and whether it splits this county in any way. In the north, you sell your own house. That's what's happened. You tart it up, you tidy it, you make sure it's all neat. People come round, and eventually somebody wants to buy it, and you sell your house. In the south, you don't bother doing anything to it at the moment. You don't decorate it, you don't even bother tidying up, and you don't show people around yourself. That's what the estate agents do, because houses there will sell, and it's a completely different landscape in a completely different country. And so we're having this dividing, this pulling apart of what's happening in Britain between the north and the south, and particularly in the last 5 years. That's been the dramatic thing. Now, I said I began writing this 2.5 years ago. I had to keep on changing it, changing what I was writing, because things changed. And you often forget this, but in the middle of last summer, it looked as if house prices were actually going down in London. There was a month when Right Move recorded a drop. That happened to be the month before David Cameron brought forward the Help to Buy scheme, which was supposed to be coming in January this year, and was actually announced in time for the Conservative Party conference in October. And I think partly because there was a chance that London bubble was going to burst last summer. As it is, you'll know now that house prices have gone up £50,000 on average in the last year in London, and you have a kind of trickle out, but it's much muted. As soon as you get this far away from London, it's much, much less. But the whole landscape has been changing. So let me just go back to basics. I'm just going to talk for about another quarter of an hour, and then I really want you to ask questions, because it makes much more sense than me rattling on. The common refrain about housing is that we need to build. Our problem is that we don't have enough houses. We need to build 100,000, 200,000 extra homes a year if we're going to have enough housing to house ourselves. Now, I've been suspicious about this, and the reason I was suspicious was that in 1989-90, when I was going for my first research job a long time ago, the Roundtree Foundation wanted us to show that you needed to build 100,000 homes a year back then. If you actually look at how much we built, we haven't built that many houses in the last 10 years, but we have built an enormous number of rooms. We've built so many rooms onto existing houses. It's as if we have been building 100,000 extra a year. So we've been building into lofts, we've been building on top of garages, we've been putting extensions out the back. The effect of that is that by 2011, we've got more rooms per person than we'd ever had. And about 30 to 40 million empty bedrooms not being slept in every night in the whole of the country. And the highest number of empty bedrooms that we've ever had. And the highest housing inequality that we've ever had. So the best tenth of people, best off housed tenth, have on average by 2011, and this is not my work, it's Becky Tunstall's work, who's Professor of Housing at York, the best off tenth have five times more rooms per person in their homes than the worst off tenth for people in Britain. It's five times more rooms, not just bedrooms, more rooms in general per person. And of course that is one elderly person, you know, in a house with 10 or 15 rooms. But that's the best off tenth in the whole of the UK. That inequality in 2011 surpasses the last high point of inequality in housing, which was 1911. If you look at rooms and how we're housed, 1911, and I'm trying to do this without, I normally use slides, but I'm trying to teach myself to do this without slides. 1911, so if you imagine a graph, we'll pretend we're doing a slide here. 1911, we were very unequal. The best off were pretty well housed, had lots of rooms. The poor were living in squalor. Actually became slightly more unequal to 1921. And then from then onwards, we became better and better housed. And that inequality between the best off and worst off people in Britain fell and fell. 1921 to 31. 31 to 51. We didn't have any numbers during the war. 51 to 61. 61 to 71. 71 to 81. We became better and better housed and more equally housed because we built decent-sized council houses for people. The big townhouses in London, the ones in Eaton Square and so on, they were cut up and subdivided because the rich could no longer afford to keep to run the big houses and they didn't have servants anymore. So you got flats in London. Everybody squeezed into housing better. The whole thing improved all the way through to 81. And then from 81 onwards, it became more unequally distributed. We got more second homes, more holiday homes, more spare homes. We got right to buy without a corresponding right to sell. I'm in favour of right to buy, but there was no counteracting force. And the effect of right to buy is that maisonettes and other council property, which was efficiently used, you only got it if you were a family with kids. That was bought up by private landlords eventually. And the private landlords simply rent out to whoever can pay the highest rent, which is often a single adult or a pair of adults with no kids. So large swathes of London are now our estates where they have signs that say no ball games, where there are no kids to even read the signs, let alone wanting to play ball games. And this causes lots and lots of problems. So the underlying argument in the book is that the reason we have problems with housing is because we have problems with income inequality and other inequalities that we're eventually now seeing coming out in terms of housing. There are other problems on top of that. Well, not necessarily problems, they're a blessing. But one is ageing. When we died in our 70s, this was highly efficient in terms of housing stock. I mean, that has to be said. And we did not plan for what happens when so many of us make it into our 90s. We haven't had a decent plan for this. And if you want to do one thing to improve housing for many, many people in Britain, given those 30 to 40 unused bedrooms, many of those bedrooms are needed. They're the bedrooms for somebody who's going to come and visit. They're the bedrooms for a child who's away from home and may come back. We've got enough bedrooms for every family to have a spare bedroom and still some more. If you wanted to do one thing to improve our situation, you would make it easier for people who want to downsize to downsize. Lots of people actually want to downsize when you ask them. They don't want to be heating a large house anymore. They don't want to be cleaning a large house anymore. But a large house gives them security, and it gives their children security in the future because they're going to inherit the money. What people want to downsize to is something smaller that's secure. So what they need is secure renting. They need to know that they can rent for at least 5 or 10 years in the proper. And if you could begin to bring back that, which we used to have, then people who own property which is larger than they need would, on the edge of it, be encouraged to sell more often and to move and to rent, because renting makes sense at the end of your life as well as at the start of your life, so that hopefully you do 15 or 20 years in this rented property, but if your hip goes or something else goes, you're renting. You can jump out and you can jump into something where you don't have to go upstairs anymore. We don't have a plan for this at this end of life at all. That needs sorting out. But that requires better quality laws and rights about renting. And that bumps right up against people being told that you need to buy a second or third property to rent out as your pension for the future for you. And what we've done is we've told people that they are responsible for their own futures, for them and their families. And once you tell people that, it makes sense for families to use housing inefficiently as nest eggs, to hold on to it, to try to give some protection, if not for themselves, for their kids. And we end up using housing more and more inefficiently in general, and so people have a problem finding housing and the prices go up and up and up. Then on top of that, the government comes in with numerous schemes designed to get banks to lend to people that even are incredibly irresponsible banks, would not be prepared to lend to without the Help to Buy schemes, which I'm happy to go on and on and on about. But I've realised I've only got about 5 more minutes before I must stop lecturing you about all this. The thing that surprised me most about the book, two things. One is that the most positive reviews have been from the right-wing press. And I have never had positive reviews from the right-wing press in my life before. So the Telegraph loved it. Times wasn't so sure, but the FT loved it. Guardian didn't like it the most because I don't advocate the mass building of new council estates, which I'm again happy to talk about. What I am in favour of is a thing called right to sell, which we already have under English and Welsh and Scottish law, but not in Northern Ireland, and it's being used. And the right to sell is if you're having problems with your mortgage, you can arrange for your property, which is owned by your bank or building society, not by you, to become owned by a housing association. You stay in it and you become a tenant. Your kids don't have to move. And this has all kinds of big long-term benefits. And it's already happened, but only in the hundreds. So several hundred families in Sheffield have now done this. The right-wing press like it, the left-wing press don't, because I'm generally not in favour of mass council building or of much building apart from London and parts of the South East. So that was one surprise. And the second surprise is I offer kind of at least 12 things you could do in the book, and there are more, and sort of say it doesn't really matter what you do. In fact, if you do any of these things, it would be helpful. And on the edge of it, bringing in capital gains tax in London for overseas buyers, which Osborne's going to do from May 2015, might be a bit helpful. But the main three political parties are absolutely paranoid of suggesting anything other than build. They won't touch anything. To the extent that, I suppose I'm talking out of turn here slightly, but the shadow housing minister was doing a consultation and said, does anybody suggest something? So I thought, oh, I'll suggest the weakest possible thing. I said, I'll suggest what they do in Scotland. In Scotland, they've changed the law so that letting agencies are no longer allowed to charge you lots of fees to rent. You know, a fee for getting a list of furniture made, a fee for this, a fee for that. It's all now illegal in Scotland. The whole letting system still works in Scotland, but people are not getting ripped off. So I said, why don't you just copy what they've done in Scotland and do it in England? And she said, oh, I'm not sure we can interfere in the market like that. Oh. And nothing. This is Labour. Absolutely nothing. Not a scintilla of a suggestion. They just about just have their mansion tax that they're not sure about. Liberals just have their mansion tax they're not sure about. Maybe they're doing the council tax thing. But the complete and utter fear of the parties, of those two parties, to do anything about housing, while housing is becoming the major cost of living issue, particularly for young people, well, not so young, people at my age, for that brief moment, if you're lucky at my age, where you actually are able to buy, and then of course you have the paranoia that you've bought at exactly the wrong time, But for 30-year-olds, 35-year-olds, 40-year-olds, you know, I'm 46, I'm older than this lot. You know, this dominates their lives. People 25, 20-year-olds down in London, they're just interested in good rights for tenants. They don't think they're ever going to buy. And buying makes sense when you want to look after a property. Renting makes sense when you want somebody else to look after a property. But we're moving away from that world in which you could sensibly interact with housing and have a good life and not be scared about what's happening to it. And if you're well housed or well sorted out, the problem is that your relatives won't be, and you know that, and the generation beneath you won't be, unless your family is shrinking and it's a single child, a single child, a single child going down the generations, and then maybe just they'll be okay. But that's the kind of, that's the way we're heading at the moment. I think if you're trying to understand the politics of it, for the Conservative Party, it makes a lot of sense to try and push the value of housing up as high as possible to May 2015, and then it doesn't matter what happens today after the election. You can maybe even win an outright majority. It's very, very hard for them to win an outright majority now because the country's become so polarised. But I can understand the Conservatives. I think that's the game. And house price crash 6 months before the election is really bad news for the Conservatives. But why the Liberals are kind of playing along with that, I find hard to understand. And Labour the hardest, really. Because they'll talk about the cost of fuel, you know, they'll talk about other things, but they won't talk about rents, and they won't talk about mortgages, even though this is many, many people's fears. In the paper today, it was saying that the banks are being stress tested. And the stress test for the banks is, will our banks survive or not fold if interest rates rise to 5%? Now, I can tell by looking at you that there are people in this audience who know that interest rates can go above 5%, right? But we're supposed... And I don't want to leave you with a question on my bewilderment, but that, having done the book, and there's much else going on apart from this book about housing. There is the Intergenerational Foundation. There's a group called Priced Out in London. London's full of angry young people who've done everything right in life. They've got amazing degrees, qualifications. They've actually landed the jobs when no other young people can land jobs. Right? Everything's going fine for them. And they can't possibly ever buy, so they start pressure groups. And they're quite good at this kind of thing. They can make websites and so on. So that there's lots and lots going on, but no inkling from our politicians that they will offer anything, any respite, or even a suggestion of what will they do when eventually the crash comes? How will you keep people in their houses? Will we learn any lessons from what's happened in Cyprus, or Greece, or Italy, or Portugal, or Spain, or Ireland, which is not very far away, or Iceland? You know, and the message is, oh, don't worry, that kind of thing doesn't happen here. The English will always keep their house prices up. The house prices going up is fine. Somebody will come along to buy it. And the last thing I want to leave you is who's going to buy them? Who is going to buy them in the end? Somebody said Russians. And the problem is, we've already got 2,000 Russian millionaire families in London. There are not that many... The Russian population is actually smaller than Turkey. Overall population of Russia is less than Turkey. There are not that many super rich Russians out there. We've got half the world super rich already. Right? Even if the rest of them decide they want to buy a flat, we're going to run out of the world super rich at some point. There is trouble ahead. I can't say when there is trouble ahead. I won't pretend. One thing I have learned from having been a young housing researcher in 89 to now is not to try to predict when the crash will happen or whatever and how wrong you can get it. But a crash always happens, and a crash is always bigger the higher up the whole thing goes. And you should be able to plan for this. And we've got more housing per person of a higher quality than we've ever had before. We were a much poorer country than we were some years ago. So why are we not sorting this out so that people are not so scared about how they're going to be housed and what's going to happen in the future, given that most of it can be solved without having to do any building or anything else, just somewhere calming people down and helping people who want to move into smaller houses, so people who are trying to start families can actually start their families.
No politician wants to give back.
Because they don't, yeah, but it's, this is, I mean, I'm naive about, I suppose the bad news is that you're not all going to become rich from the future increased property value of your housing. And maybe that's what's gone on, in that so many people think that their future's going to be secure because they're going to see a further increase, like the increase that's happened before. But the kind of good news is that we haven't had an earthquake that's wiped out a quarter of our housing. You know, that the Luftwaffe haven't just come over and bombed lots of it. It's there. The good news is that we have enough space to house ourselves in. We could do with building some, but our main problem is that we are using it in a more and more inefficient way year on year on year. So the housing is there. You've been really patient, that's half an hour, so I'm going to stop and please ask questions. And I'll try and keep my answers relatively short to let lots of people ask them. Okay.